Mr. Speaker.
That's the voice of Maureen Breen, who retired last week as Parliament's Sergeant-at-Arms. Maureen was the second female sergeant, and we'll be hearing more from her later in the programme. Last week was the first week of a four-week adjournment, and although the absence of MPs and ministers meant the debating chamber was deserted, the corridors were as busy as ever as visitors came to see their House of Representatives for themselves. In charge of the educational tours of the House is Miranda Thompson from Parliament's Education Services.
So what we do is we deliver visits, they're pre-booked visits for any type of education group from primary right through up to tertiary. And in any given year we can put up to between 14 to 15,000 students through a year. So the education room here, the education centre, we've got it set out like a mock debating chamber. So we've purposely done that, so we'll describe the various roles, the role of the speaker, the role of the clerk, where government sits, where opposition sits, the whip's role, the function of the mace. We also can show them little video clips. We've got one of the sergeant being led into the house. So if they're not actually going to go and see it in action, they can see it here. And you know, it's also an opportunity for them to ask any questions as well. We do find that a lot of the groups that come through schools, they might be doing a particular curriculum study. And we do also have resources, which we've developed, which we provide free to schools for pre- and post-visit work. So the idea is that it's not just a tour, it's not just a look around. It's actually, we've changed the terminology. We call it an education visit, and it is about learning about this place and how it works. So it's not just kind of a look around the buildings, it's actually a learning experience, often linked to the curriculum. The other thing that we can arrange for groups on request is that they can meet with their electorate MP. If they book a visit in the afternoon, part of the visit is spending some time in the public gallery watching Parliament in session, and that's actually usually quite a highlight for some of the groups because they've never seen Parliament live. Yeah, so we start here in the Education Centre. We have the presentation, we go through what all the functions of all the buildings are, then we put security stickers on and we start to walk.
Okay, well, we'll go on a bit of a mock tour, I suppose.
Yeah,
if that's all right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so once we start walking around, we go to a number of venues. We do always bring them here to the chamber because obviously this is the jewel in the crown. This is the room that everybody wants to see. And we'll spend probably about 10 or 15 minutes in each venue. So we go to the theatreette, we go to the debating chamber, we go to the legislative council chamber, we go to a select committee room, we go to the library, we walk down the speaker's corridor. And so it's very much a sort of interactive experience. We don't just stand up and spout a lot of information. The way we kind of try to do it is that we ask lots of questions and we use that kind of question-answer technique to get the students to engage. And we find usually once they get started, it's very hard to stop them talking. So, for instance, here in the chamber, we talk to them about how often they meet here, how things are structured. So we'll talk a little bit about question time, what the purpose of question time is. Then we'll talk about things like the fact that we're a constitutional monarchy. We talk about the roles of the executive, what the government does, what the opposition does. We talk to them about the roles of the speaker and the clerk, and we give them an idea of where everybody sits. We also like to point out the fact that there's public galleries up here and that people can come and visit Parliament because this is their Parliament. So if they book in the afternoon, they can sit in the public gallery. If they've met with their electorate MP, we try and sit them on the side so they can look at their MP. They usually find that a real eye-opener. Sometimes they've seen a little clip of it on TV, but when they're actually here, they can kind of feel the atmosphere of the place. And then we'll often go, say, into the legislative council council chamber and have a bit of a debrief. So we'll say, what did you think of that? And we find that it really generates a lot of really interesting conversation. I mean, even if the students start out quite quiet at the beginning of the visit, they get all excited, particularly once they've been in here and they've seen it happening, and they've usually, you know, have a lot more questions to ask after that. So obviously sitting and watching Parliament in action is a really kind of powerful experience for them, and they may have never done it before.
And what about the select committees? Are they normally sitting when you take people?
So when we take them to the select committees, no, the rooms are usually empty. But we talk a little bit about the function of the select committee, and depending on the age group, one of the techniques I like to use is I like to throw out a mock bill and see what kind of a response that I get, and then say, okay, now if you were talking to the select committee, what might you say to them? So, for example, I might say, okay, there's a bill before Parliament to shorten the school week from 5 days to 4. Who's for that? And, of course, on the surface it sounds quite attractive, but then the idea is we try and get them to unpack what the implications of that would be, and that so that they can understand that making a law is much more complex than just, oh, yeah, that sounds good. You actually have to dig deeper and look at how, if that becomes a law, how that is going to impact on a whole variety of people. And once again, that's an experience that they usually get really into. And I often have to say to them at the end, now just remember, I just made that up. It's not happening. Yeah.
There's nothing stopping young people making submissions in real life either, is there?
Absolutely, absolutely not. And we do talk about that in the select committee room. We talk about the fact that it's one of the ways you can participate in the work of Parliament, and I give them often examples. I've used an example of two young boys who came and made a submission to a select committee discussing the laws around international drivers, mm-hmm. Because they were affected by that. We've used numerous examples of young people who have either presented a petition or have come and made a submission to a select committee. And a lot of them are really surprised that you can make a submission at any age. But we say that you don't have to wait till you're voting. You don't have to wait till you're 18 to start getting involved. And so we might say, number one, find out what's going here. Come and sit in the gallery. Find out the things that matter to you. You know, find out the things that you actually have an opinion about, or start forming an opinion about it. And then if there is something that you do feel really strongly about, find out about what you can do about it. I think it's a matter of young people understanding what they can do now, not wait till they're 18.
Yeah. Mm. School holidays at the moment, but it's not no less busy for you, is it?
No, we take all sorts of groups. So, I mean, we've got university groups coming through. I just did a group this morning from Victoria University. We've had visiting people, so people who come from overseas, so it doesn't really slow down for us. We just get fewer of the school groups, but we get lots of other types of groups.
And you've got one coming through soon, so we probably should let you go.
That's right.
All right. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.
That was Miranda Thompson, the lead parliamentary educator for Parliament's Education Services. And a special feature of the tours around Parliament has been meeting up with the Sergeant-at-Arms, Maureen Breen, who spoke with Tom Fruin about her role.
I think that it's important for each sergeant to put their own mark on the tradition of the role of Sergeant-at-Arms. So I decided that I would meet the school children who come into the house in the mornings when the house is not sitting, and I meet them at the door with the mace, and I lead them in, and we put the mace on the table, and I tell them about the mace and about the running of Parliament. And if it's a small enough group, we might sit in the members' chairs, but that doesn't happen very often, and just generally give them an idea about what it's like when the House is sitting, because they're not going to be there in the afternoons, and I think it's good for them to learn a bit about the House.
Have you noticed a change in the knowledge of the children over time? Are they more knowledgeable about Parliament now?
Yes, they are. The thing that I really have been impressed about is the quality of the questions, the interest that they take in what goes on, and the just the interesting questions that they do ask about what would happen if the house wasn't going to be here in Wellington if we had an earthquake and we had to shift, all of those sorts of things. They want to know what happens when the ministers don't or the MPs don't behave themselves. They're quite interested and they know quite a bit about what goes on in the house.
What sort of incidents in the chamber stick in the memory?
Regarding the house sittings, the same-sex marriage law reform, that was a huge moment for, I think, New Zealand as a society and a big moment in the Parliament. Also, we had a dedication of the plaques that are on the walls. We had a dedication ceremony a couple of years ago for the plaques for Afghanistan, East Timor and the peacekeeping forces, and some of the members of the families of the soldiers who had died in Afghanistan were there. And it was a very moving but very wonderful time to witness. One of the really good things about having worked in the role of the sergeant is the interaction between the speaker and the presiding officers, and I have really enjoyed getting to know them better and them getting to know me better, and I think we've successfully managed to get the two roles to work very well while I've been here. It's a privilege to be in the Parliament, and it's also a privilege to have been able to develop that relationship and trust with the MPs and the ministers.
Well, they obviously enjoyed their relationship with you, because that standing ovation went on for nearly half a minute.
It did. I was very honoured. Yes, it did. But I do think that to be available for them to come to, I think that has. I did feel very honoured about how that went the other day.
That was on the Thursday before last, on the eve of this adjournment, when the Speaker, David Carter, took the opportunity before question time to farewell Maureen Breen and 15 other messengers and chamber staff.
Honourable members will also be aware that tomorrow a number of our chamber and gallery staff will be retiring. This is our last day to acknowledge this fact. Collectively, their loyal service totals around 180 years. I ask that members take this opportunity to acknowledge their contribution to us, to thank them, and to wish them well for their future.
Also during the final sitting week before the four-week adjournment, the House made progress on the 12-hour estimates debate, which is divided into 10 separate debates, each covering a broad area of government spending. At the debate's outset, Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard explained its format.
Each debate will be led by a call from the chairperson of the select committee nominated by the government as the major committee reporting on the sector. Committee chairpersons are expected to focus their speeches on the major findings of the committee. I will expect that following that, speeches may become more partisan.
Mr. Mallard outlined the 10 areas up for debate and called on MPs to keep their speeches relevant.
To the government's current spending plans, the following sectors are currently available for debate: environment, external, finance and government administration, health, justice, primary and social development housing. Members, we come first to the votes in the environment sector. The question is that vote conservation, vote environment and vote parliamentary commissioner for the environment stand part of the schedules.
Mr. Chairman.
Scott Simpson.
Scott Simpson is the chair of the Local Government and Environment Committee, which undertook scrutiny of this year's budget allocations for the environment sector.
We heard from three ministers in this area, the Minister for the Environment, the Honourable Nick Smith, Minister for Climate Change Issues, the Honourable Paula Bennett, and of course Minister for Conservation, the Honourable Maggie Barry. Underlying their messages to the committee, sir, and detailed in the reports, was essentially what was the government's blue-green agenda, which seeks to ensure that economic growth and improving the environment can and should go hand in hand.
And one of the ministers mentioned in that speech, Climate Change Issues Minister Paula Bennett, later received praise from an unlikely ally, the Greens' Kennedy Graham.
I believe the minister's new approach opens the door to a genuine cross-party dialogue
in climate policy in this House, something that has been lacking for over a decade. I detect a newfound interest among colleagues along these lines in 2016, and I pledge the Green Party's positive engagement in such a development. There will be areas where we differ, but an enduring cross-party foundation for climate policy in this country is critically important and long overdue.
Meanwhile, when it came time for MPs to debate the primary sector, National's Primary Production Committee Chairman, Ian McKelvey, made the most of the debate's wide-ranging nature to survey a number of the government's spending plans.
One is the irrigation investment, or Crown Investment Irrigation Fund, which amounts to some $102 million. I want to talk briefly also about the PGP partnerships, some $720 million worth of government funding and private investment. Just on the issue of TB funding, which has had some changes this year, some $69.8 million worth of government funding added to the TB challenge, along with the $30 million that we already had in this area.
Mr McKelvey was followed in the debate by Labour's Damien O'Connor.
The National Government, the farmers' friends. Well, I bet that member over there who's a farmer, I bet he's got some off-farm income, if he was a normal farmer, that is. Mr Speaker, never have confidence levels been so low as they are at the moment across the whole of the agricultural sector, because the National Government has completely failed to offer any vision or any direction across agriculture. Mr Speaker, what has National done with its funding? It has sprayed funding around the primary sectors like some feral cat trying to identify its territory, Mr Speaker, and get support from every single sector by giving them a bit of money but providing them with no leadership and no direction.
The estimates debate also featured scrutiny of the external sector. Its scope outlined by Deputy Chair of the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee, National's Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr Chair. It's a pleasure to speak to this, the external sector, which, as you've mentioned, takes into account defence, trade, humanitarian aid, customs, disarmament and many other ministries. Mr Chair, I'm going to limit my comments here tonight, this afternoon, to defence and customs particularly. And I'd like to start by talking about the defence white paper that came out a few months ago that set New Zealand's strategic direction, strategic imperatives for the next 15 to 30 years.
Also focusing on the defence budget was New Zealand First's defence spokesman, Ron Mark.
It does give New Zealand First a little bit of concern, Mr Chair, when we read the report from the Foreign Affairs Defence Select Committee on defence, not so much because the brief coverage that it does give on various matters, but probably, Mr Chair, because of the matters that aren't contained in this document. One could ask why there is such an absence of any reference to the plying through our waters of nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed submarines, which some reports might suggest are about 120 from a smattering of countries. Other reports suggest there might be something as high as 300, 350 going through our waters.
And clandestine submarine visits weren't the only area of concern for Mr Mark.
With respect to how we would protect our territorial waters or our EEZ on the limited naval resources we have now if we would establish a marine reserve up in the Kermadec, which we would therefore be responsible for policing, monitoring and enforcing, one would expect. But there's no mention of how we intend enforcing, monitoring, policing from illegal fishers or up in that area if we do go to the extent of declaring a marine reserve up at the Kermadec.
Ron Mark's questions about the Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary, though not submarines, were later addressed by Defence Minister Gerry Brownlee.
And I note Mr Mark was saying that, well, if we turn it into a reserve, how are we going to patrol it? Well, here's a question. It's our territory at the moment. How do we patrol it? Nothing changes, effectively, but over time, we do need to have naval capacity that can run missions through that part of the New Zealand Protectorate. And yes, there will be pirating going on there at the moment. That's why we also want to invest heavily in better surveillance aircraft. The Orions are a great aircraft, but a new aircraft, and we want four of them, is what's required, and we'll be acquiring those in the early part of the 2020s.
Another area up for debate was the finance and government administration sector. That part of the estimates debate kicked off by the only opposition select committee chairperson, the Government Administration Committee Chair, Ruth Dyson.
Mr Chairman, this is a combination of two committees, the Finance Committee and the Government Administration Committee. And even though our committee had about six votes, estimates referred to it, this year with a minister, only two of them are covered in this particular segment.
They are State Services and the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet.
When we had the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet in, there's a huge variety of issues that we could have raised with them, but our committee concentrated primarily on the responsibility of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet to oversee the Canterbury earthquake recovery portfolio. It was very clear from the officials' response to the committee that they share the concerns of Treasury about the risks that are entailed in the government investment projects, the constant delay in those projects and lack of reporting around them. So that was reassuring to the committee that the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet said Treasury have raised these major concerns and we share them. So we felt that we were at last getting some accountability for the delays, the budget blowouts, the broken promises really that people in Canterbury have felt in relation to anchor projects particularly.
Also speaking on the topic of Christchurch, albeit on a more positive note, was Finance Minister Bill English.
I just want to acknowledge the huge contribution of my colleague, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee, in getting to this stage, frankly. The Convention Centre is just one of any number of highly complex and challenging commercial and engineering problems that had to be solved in Christchurch, and he showed a remarkable ability to deal with most of them. And Mr Speaker, is that kind of pragmatism that is guiding the way the government spends a lot of the money referred to here in these estimates.
And the Canterbury rebuild also featured in a later speech from Justice and Courts Minister Amy Adams when she rose to speak on the justice sector of the estimates debate.
Finally, the Christchurch Justice and Emergency Precinct, which really has been a flagship of the regeneration of the government in central Christchurch. It is looking fantastic. That the shape, the exterior is almost complete. It is a 42,000 square metre complex, $350 million project, and it will see in a very tangible way the redevelopment, the rejuvenation, the recovery of the city and the district that I love so much, Mr Speaker. I can't wait to be there for the opening.
Meanwhile, as Labour's Calvin Davis pointed out, the justice sector of the estimates debate includes his shadow portfolio of corrections.
And I have to say it's the portfolio that just keeps giving. I think that corrections has, or the National Party has actually solved, come up with another plan to solve the homelessness issue, and that's just to keep on locking people up in prison.
The police is another area included in the justice sector, which was the focus of a speech from the Greens' David Clendon.
Our rural police in the north are so under-resourced, so stretched, that they are unable to keep up with spates of burglaries. They are unable to patrol sufficiently to discourage the burglars. There are numerous small businesses in Kaikoui, in Kaitaia, in Okaiho, which have closed or are in the process of closing because of this government's very, dare I say it, parsimonious approach to funding, properly resourcing our police force. And that indeed has been a theme of this entire budget. You're simply moving a cost from today to tomorrow.
Earlier, the health sector of the estimates debate included a contribution from Labour's health spokeswoman and health committee member, Annette King.
We looked at the vote health, the amount of money that had been put in this budget 2016, and to see whether there was sufficient being put into the budget to keep up with health demographics and inflation. Unfortunately, the budget does not meet all the demands in health, in demographic pressures, in aged care and cost pressures. What they really needed in this budget was an additional $635 million to just keep up.
The debate on the health sector also featured Annette King's old sparring mate, Health Minister Jonathan Coleman.
We had a set of really deeply anaesthetising speeches from the opposition tonight. They could not name one service that is not better under a national government. So the New Zealand health system, when you look at it internationally, is performing exceedingly well. Under this government, we've maintained vote health at 6.5% of GDP. It's actually higher than the average less than 6% of GDP that there was under the Labor government. They were saying there's $1.7 billion cut for the health budget. Completely untrue. The health budget over time has gone up by over $4 billion.
And the final sector up for debate before the House rose for the four-week adjournment was social development and housing, which was an area readily taken up by Labor's housing spokesman, Phil Twyford.
We've seen a whole lot of other policies from Nick Smith. We've seen special housing areas where he promised 39,000 houses in Auckland. Very few of them are affordable, and they've only built 1,000 in nearly 3 years. It's a total and utter failure.
But Building and Housing Minister Nick Smith gave as good as he got.
And so when members of the opposition stand up and say, oh, there's no houses being built, there's nothing happening, I say, look at the record levels of house building activity. They know in their heart of hearts that there is more houses that are being built today than there has in many decades.
The estimates debate was interrupted when the House rose for the adjournment with 4 hours and 54 minutes remaining. But before that happened, Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard took one last chance to farewell Parliament's messengers.
Members, as we finish, I would like once again to acknowledge the fact that we are losing a group of people who have worked with us and have been our friends, some of them for many years, some in the roles that they are in now and some in previous roles and more recently in current roles. I'm going to profess a lack of understanding of the economics of the change, notwithstanding some understanding of the way government accounting systems work. I also want to note that over the years there have been some changes. When I was first a Member of Parliament, there was a messenger stationed permanently in the billiard room, which is now the Grand Hall, whose role it was to set up the tables and to play. There were always odds and sods of members around and to play against the lonely members who couldn't find anyone else to play with. But the rules were, of course, that the messengers always had to lose. The other point which I have recounted to some of the people who are leaving is in my first term I used to act as a whip, sit in the government whip's chairs, and in the evening sessions, sitting in the chair at the speaker's door was a messenger who from memory's name was Trevor. Trevor was a standing orders expert. Probably there were three or four members who were better experts than he was, Palmer and Cullen and Muldoon and McKinnon, but certainly he knew more about the standing orders and speakers' rulings than either of the speakers, and much, much more than the chairman of committee at the time. When I was taking or replying to a point of order, I would look beyond the speaker or the chairman to Trevor at the door, when I was on the right track, he would just quietly nod his head. And when I was getting the standing orders wrong, he would shake his head and push me back in the right direction. I think, I hear the interjection from my right, they still know more. So what I'm saying is that times have changed and times will change. But I do want to acknowledge an enormous loss, both of workmates and friends. Thank you.
Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard with that tribute to Parliament's messengers. I'm Rhys Lyon reporting for parliamenttoday.co.nz with funding from Parliament.